Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle. Because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, my name is Simon Rich. And I feel extremely grateful about being Conan O'Brien's friend.
That was sweet. And I think sincere. That was really nice.
I went for it.
We're going to run that through. We have a machine here called the Snarkometer.
And just dial it up.
Everything comes out in Dennis Miller's voice. I feel really fucking great about being Conan O'Brien's friend. Cha-cha.
Fall is here. Hear the yell. Back to school. Ring the bell. Brand new shoes. Walking blues. Climb the fence. Books and pens. I can tell that we are gonna be friends. Yes, I can tell that we are gonna be friends.
Hey there, and welcome to Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend. This is a glorious day. My mother always uses the word glorious. I would say, Mom, what do you think of this slice of pizza? It's glorious. She would say glorious all the time, and I'm quoting my mom. This is a glorious day because for the first time since she left to go on maternity leave and give birth to Mikey and Charlie, her beautiful twin boys, Sonam Avsesian is back in the podcast studio. Sonam!
It's good to be. Can I say something? It was good to be back.
Yeah, you know, it was nice. It was kind of emotional because you zoomed in once,
yeah,
kind of recently, but to have you back here in the studio, and of course I've been here with David. Mm-hmm. David is Sona's assistant, and yes, you heard that what? Right. My assistant has an assistant named David Hopping.
He's more your assistant now.
Well, yes. What I'm saying is, yeah, you used to have an assistant.
That's right.
We had the best time.
It was a great couple of years.
Which enabled you to do absolutely nothing.
Sona was the best boss, though.
Yeah, it was.
Yeah. So, anywho,
he says I was the best boss.
Yeah, because he lets you watch, Big Brother or whatever it is you watch.
Grey's Anatomy.
Okay.
A lot,
whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever. Yeah. I don't know.
You're so jealous.
I haven't watched TV since Mayberry RFD went off the air. Anyway,
no one got that.
David, there's two people out there who got it, and boy, are they happy. And both of them worked on that show. Listen, David has been doing his best to fill in for you, and I think doing a lovely job.
Excellent.
Doing a fantastic job here in the podcast studio. But great to have you back, Sona. And people have missed you. People have told me how, everywhere I go, people say, how's Sona doing?
Yeah, oh, that's nice. Yeah. I was really excited to come back. And then I think 5 minutes into being here.
Can I tell you what happened?
I want you to say it.
Okay. So I see Sona in the parking lot. We're here at the Earwolf Studios on Sunset Boulevard. Just a fun fact, right across the street from where Greg Daniels and I got started in the business in 1985.
That's cool.
At Sunset Gower Studios.
Very
not
cool.
Necessarily the news. Little fun fact. Anyway, I run into you in the parking lot as we're both about to walk up, and we hug. And it's kind of emotional. You're back. You look fantastic. Doesn't she look fantastic?
She looks great.
Yeah, thanks, you look amazing.
You really do.
Thank you.
Look amazing. And we're just so happy to see you.
Thrilled.
And then we walk into the offices, and there are a couple of people here, and Ruthie's here from Team Coco, and she's happy to see you and hugs you.
So nice.
And David's hugging you, and everyone's hugging you. I want to say maybe at most 2 minutes went by.
Yeah.
When you found that there's these energy bars here, little snack bars.
Yeah.
And so Sona unwrapped one of the snack bars and was eating it. and you seemed really happy and everyone was really happy. And you're about halfway through this bar. It's delicious. I said, what you got there, Sona? And you went, what is it? What was it?
It was a Kashi chocolate almond, sea salt, delicious, you know, bar.
Yeah. It and you were halfway through. You're really enjoying it. And I said, what is that? And you went, oh, it's this. And I said, and what flavor is it? And you held it out just a little bit and I smacked it out of your hands. And it went flying across the room and shattered into a million pieces. Uh-huh. And you shouted out, you dick!
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking, that's what I do.
Minutes.
That's what I do. And you think just because you gave birth to two babies.
Oh my God.
That you get to come in here now and be treated differently. And what I'm trying to teach you is no. You've got to get your reflexes back. I've done that on the I've done that to you hundreds of times. Yes. It's actually featured in a very popular YouTube video that's out there where I demonstrate how I do it in front of an HR person.
Right. No
and
shame.
You held it out to me because you completely forgot. You were busy giving life to the world that you forgot
what it's like
to guard your Kashi bar around Conan.
I wasn't even angry at you. I was angry at myself.
Appropriate.
Because I should have seen that coming a mile away.
Right.
And I now at this point, like you did that once when we were on the show where I was holding a plate of watermelon. You're like, what do you eat there? And I'm like, oh, it's a plate of watermelon. And you didn't hit it. You kicked it.
That was hard.
Did a roundhouse kick.
Because I had to kick
it. Out of my hand.
Yes. And I kicked it perfectly. So it went flying. And you know, that takes real coordination. It was,
yeah.
I have very long legs, and I did a spinning kick and hit the plate, which was paper, fortunately, but I didn't care. It could have been on a Ming vase, and I wouldn't have cared. And the watermelon went flying. Crew members were there. And they weren't used to this.
And it's always right when I really want a snack, I find the perfect snack, and it's almost as if something triggers in your brain where you're like, Sona's enjoying herself.
Oh, yes.
Let me ruin it.
The way a shark can smell blood, I can smell joy, and I have to attack. If I sense joy, I must strike. And you get so happy about your snacks.
All I need is food, and you take it away from me.
Yeah. Exactly.
Oh, and you love it. You're so happy.
Oh my God, it made me so happy. I'm so glad you're back, and I'm so glad you're snacking, and then gullible enough to, when I innocently inquire, so what flavor is it? You hold it out a little closer to me.
Oh, God.
Well, it's chocolate, but it's got a little fudge swirl, and quatang! Goes flying.
Minutes.
At least your hair's still up.
Yeah.
She hasn't done that yet?
Oh, yeah. When you just punch I have my hair in a bun and you just punch the bun for no reason.
I punch the bun because I think that doesn't count as actually hitting you because those are dead cells.
You never get my head. You don't.
No. God, no, that would be abuse. No. I wouldn't touch the skull or the head, but I've figured out a way that if I punch quickly, like a little rabbit punch, the bun of your hair, it completely falls apart and you go, oh, man.
So good to be back.
Anyway, as you can tell, I've missed you.
Oh, I've missed you too. It was seconds. Just seconds.
Well, we are happy to have you, and the twins are doing well. You send me pictures every day,
yeah.
And my wife makes fun of me because I run around the house and make everyone look at the pictures. I'm not related to you, you know,
we're surrogate relations.
Yeah, we have a relationship, yes. But I run around and I go, look, here's the latest of Mikey and Charlie, look. And they love looking at them, but my wife said you were far more happy about these children than you were about your own children.
God.
Which is true.
That's nice. Thanks, Conan.
Yeah, well, you know me, I'm a real good guy.
Yeah.
Now, what's that you're eating right there? Quatang! Okay, well, Sona, all I caution you to do is don't eat hot soup near me anytime soon.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay.
Just probably not a good idea, because it's not my fault. I can't control myself. It's your fault.
You can control yourself.
Clearly,
that's the thing.
Clearly, I can't. Well, anyway, I'm very excited. My guest today was the youngest writer ever hired on Saturday Night Live. He's a frequent contributor to The New Yorker, and he's created such shows as Man Seeking Woman and Miracle Workers. His latest book is a delight. I so love this man's writing. It's called New Teeth, and it's available now. Very excited to talk with him today. Simon Rich, welcome. I don't find myself being envious of many people, but I envy you, Simon Rich, and I will tell you why. Your writing makes me laugh out loud. I was reading your new book, New Teeth, the other day, and I kept shrieking, and my wife and kids would come running in the room because they don't hear me laugh like that. Then I would say, wait, hold on. And then I would explain the premise of the story and then read them long passages. And anyway, this all leads up to you writing these stories. I've been reading your books for years now and looking at your stuff in The New Yorker. And I'm always put it down and think, God damn it. How come he gets to do that? How do you do that? And I'm so delighted to have you on the podcast. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you so much for the kind words. It is so thrilling to hear you say that. I'm a lifelong fan of your work and all your shows and your writing for some of my favorite shows of all time. The bigger influence on my comedy was absurdist 90s television comedy like your late night show and sketch shows that were tonally similar, that were silly and smart, like Kids in the Hall,
yep.
Mr. Show,
yep.
The State, the short-lived Ben Stiller show,
right?
The last 10 minutes or so of SNL when they were allowed to be non-topical and totally weird.
Oh my God, that was my, and I'm sure for you too, but I loved writing weird things, and some of my favorite things that I ever wrote lived at 12:45 on SNL.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, that's the sweet spot. That's
absolutely
where you want to be.
Totally, yeah. You don't always have the best set. You have like one flat that's kind of wedged in between
right.
the Weekend Update desk and like a really cool like parody set. And it's just like, okay, we have this small flat that's big enough to fit one robot.
You know? And you're like, one robot?
And you're like, I'm on it.
I'm your man.
Here I am. Get ready. Because I'm pretty sure Bill Hader has a robot voice.
Yes.
Pretty sure he can do that. And can I ask who, when you were writing for that show, like who your favorite people to write for were?
Well,
was it Hartman?
The best utility performer in the history of Saturday Night Live was Phil Hartman.
Yeah.
Because Phil Hartman, he used to describe himself as a Mr. Potato Head. You could put anything onto him and he would become that.
Yeah.
Phil Hartman, improbably, but if you look back at his work, he could play the father, he could play the grandfather, he could play the guy in a leather jacket who's a tough, who's here to beat you up.
Both Hartman and Hader, my favorite mode for them is when they're villains.
Yes.
To me, Troy McClure, Lionel Hutz, like I prefer them to be snaky and oily and sneaky.
Yes.
And that always was so thrilling to be able to write charming bad guys, which you can get away with Bill. And you can't get away with that with most performers.
We have so many points of commonality that it's almost absurd. Like I look at your transcript. I'm going to call it a transcript.
Yeah.
I looked up your comedy, comedic transcript, and there's so many of the, we've done so many of the same things. We both got started on the Harvard Lampoon. And that was sort of our awakening. And I want to, you know, The Simpsons, Saturday Night Live, so many points where you and I have had, I think, similar experiences and where I honestly believe you've ripped me off completely. There was a period of time where you were wearing a red pompadour wig.
Yeah, and stilts and the whole business.
But you gave me 15% of your income.
That's right, just, yeah.
Yeah, which was, I thought was incredibly kind of you. But you brought up, when you bring up villains, I remembered when I was at The Simpsons, all I wanted to do was write for Mr. Burns.
Yeah.
Because Mr. Burns is evil, which is so fun to write. It is so fun to write
the
evil.
Best.
He's comedically old, so you can have all kinds of fun with him being an intern for Thomas Alva Edison, you know.
The greatest.
Or whatever. He also has limitless wealth.
Right.
Which is fun to write because he can have an underground lair that's filled with hyperbaric chambers, whatever you want.
Yeah.
And I remember when I was at The Simpsons, just constantly wanting to bring Mr. Burns into the story
when he didn't fit at all.
Yeah,
and them kind of telling me, no, you can't have more chocolate cake right now, Conan. You have to resolve Marge's issue with Homer over their marital difficulties. And I was like, God damn it. I'm telling you, I want to write about Mr. Burns' brain being put into a chimp, you know?
It really is like, it's an all-you-can-eat comedy buffet with Mr. Burns.
And yeah.
I mean, the funniest villains often, or the kind of best-constructed villains often are weak in some way because it gives them some level of sympathy that you're allowed to make them even more evil, you know, which is why it's so brilliant that Cartman is eight.
Yes.
And overweight and mocked and, you know, he's physically kind of has a hard time getting around.
Yeah.
And I think that's like right out of the Burns playbook, you know, or to make Stewie, you know, a baby is a brilliant choice. And a lot of my favorite villains have some kind of infirmity because it just, you like them just enough that when they decide to block out the sun or whatever, you're like, okay, yeah.
I know exactly what you're talking about. And let's start, I don't talk about this much. I don't know why I don't talk about it much, but I was fairly insecure about a lot of things, didn't quite know where I fit in the world. And then I get to this very prestigious college and went there with every intention of being a serious student and scholar, bumped into the Harvard Lampoon first semester freshman year. It was like stumbling into Willy Wonka's chocolate factory.
Yeah.
I just thought, almost a religious experience of these people take seriously the stuff that's so important to me that I didn't think you could take seriously. I honestly didn't think you could take comedy writing seriously or being silly seriously.
I mean, I distinctly remember like a four-hour debate about which masturbating bear segment was the most important. You know,
at the Lampoon?
I'm
glad I did my part to move the chess piece forward.
It was literally like intense, like 4 hours. Like, no, when Masturbating Bear quit smoking,
that's
the best one, and here's why. And then somebody else being like, I disagree. I think that's when it lost its way. And like, heated debates about the silliest sketches.
When you're 18 years old, and just out of high school, and I went to a public high school, and I was a rube. I mean, I didn't know anything about anything. I got into the Lampoon, and suddenly 21-year-old seniors are saying, hey, I really like that piece you wrote, or I really like that cartoon you did. And to an 18-year-old, a 22-year-old is—
The president.
He's the president of the United States.
You can't believe.
You cannot believe that this person's making eye contact with you.
A man with a full mustache is looking you in the eye.
Someone who needs to shave.
Yeah.
It isn't an affectation. They actually—
They need it. Yeah.
Because hair grows out of their face.
Out of their face every day, daily.
I used to, at that age, I was inserting hairs into my face.
And painstaking ritual hours. Wake up in the pre-dawn hours with the tweezers and the glue.
And insert.
I remember. I still do it.
That these adults, they were adults to me, and they were full-on adults, and looked like adults, and talked like adults.
They would drink like nice beers, not just any beer. They would be like, I prefer this beer to that beer. I prefer the taste of this beer, as opposed to just like get it in my throat by the fastest physical mechanism that we have.
I'm told you had a tracheotomy so you could get the beer in even faster.
It's like, no, this beer, I prefer it. Like, what is it? What sophisticated world am I?
It's like James Bond.
Yeah.
If you have an Amstel Light, I'll take it. That guy's the coolest man ever.
The coolest thing in the world. I mean, the miracle of writing for me has been basically, it's this thing that I started doing because I didn't always feel like I fit in with other people in school. And I often felt like, okay, the things I think are funny, kids at the popular table don't necessarily think that they are funny. And I wasn't on the sports teams and I was not, you know.
The fact that you called them the sports teams.
The sports teams. Yeah. And so I was alone in my room studying The Simpsons and Kids in the Hall sketches and writing as a kind of like way to deal with the social weirdness that I felt. And then somehow through the writing, I ended up with this community of friends who saw the world in the same way that I did and who even wanted to collaborate with me. And that's the thing that I'm so grateful is when I started writing, I loved it from moment one. As soon as I started writing as a child, I was like, this is what I want to do forever. But I did not think that it was going to make me lifelong friends.
It is, it's a little like Robin Hood, where you start off and then you pick up people along the way. And then before you know it, you have your gang of merry men, your posse of people that you collect along the way.
The other amazing thing is you, in my case, I've learned so much from the people I've met along the way. Like at every stage at the Harvard Lampoon and then at SNL and then at... later on when I worked at Pixar and then on the other TV shows I did after that, I learned so much from the other writers.
That's the thing that I really like is if you can say there's your, you know, there's Mulaney's and you know, your Jack Handy's and your Jim Downey's and Robert Smigel and you know, you. There are all these people that come up with these ideas that I think, oh, this is going to be really funny. This is just funny the way it's like an ore. You can put it in a furnace and melt it down and it will just be it'll be a funny goop that then can reform into a solid. It's still funny. It's a mass. It's solid. It's not attitude. It's not getting by on a buzzword that it's not trading on your emotions. It's just got this this worth that I think is so cool.
I got to write most weeks at SNL with two writers, Marika Sawyer and John Mulaney. And the three of us wrote together most weeks. And they are the two funniest people I've ever met.
Yeah.
And I learned so much from getting to work with them. And to this day, I still can't believe they like let me tag along because they were both so much funnier than I was. Not only was everything they were doing stronger than what I was doing, it was happening at a speed that blew my mind. I mean, it's like watching, it's like being a sprinter and then racing against Usain Bolt. And you just, it's a level of speed that it almost seems magical.
Yep.
It's hard to explain how surreal it felt to write with Mulaney and Marika, because it's like it would be like meeting somebody who spoke in perfect rhyming verse in iambic pentameter, you know, without even trying.
Well, it's funny when people have an access. This makes me think of Downey, and I think it's also true of obviously of Mulaney. If they have immediately access to the right phrase,
perfectly every time.
So I remembered when I was going to go see John's show downtown in L.A., and he said, "Oh, terrific!" And then as a joke, I just said, "I plan to walk in." You know, a few minutes into your set.
To try to rattle you.
You know, no, I like, and my, the idea was, I you know, I'm just expecting, I'll use the center aisle so that you can hit me with a spot and say whatever you want to say about me. And I said, I won't walk in too quickly. And he wrote back immediately, he said, you'll walk in at a king's pace. And I was like, shit, that's the phrase. It's king's pace.
He always has it. He has it instantly.
Yeah,
he has every it instantly. Time.
A king's pace, I thought. But for my entire college career, I thought about comedy and thought about different ideas and what's the best way to be funny and why does this not work, but that works. That got me started a lot earlier, I think, than I would have otherwise been thinking about it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I was the same way. And I even the courses that I took were designed to get material. Like I purposely would take classes that I thought would like yield interesting premise ideas. So if you look at my transcript,
okay, it's really?
It's all like, yeah, no, literally it's like medieval medicine, any class I could find that had monkey in the title.
Uh-huh.
Like sometimes it'd be like really hard science classes. I could barely understand what was happening, but I was like, there might be some stuff about monkeys in here.
You're at Harvard and you're choosing courses that might help you with a comedic premise.
Yeah.
So you probably, I find if I looked at your college records, like four times you took classes on pirates.
Exactly. I literally took a class on pirates. Any class I could take about talking animals. I took a robotics class. I mean, it was just like, you know, anything I could do to try to get new premises that other people weren't going to get.
Nothing brings a family together like a large two-topping pizza. It's the perfect way to celebrate any occasion. This happens all the time at my house.
Yeah.
I say, kids, let's get together. Your father wants to tell you stories of his childhood. Nobody comes running, all right? But guess what? When I get one of those two large two-topping pizzas at Domino's, suddenly everybody wants to hear from Daddy. At Domino's, you can carry out large two-topping pizzas for just $6.99 for this week only. No limit on number of pizzas. You know, what toppings do you like? I like pepperoni.
I like pepperoni. I like olive. I like bell pepper. I like mushrooms. I know you don't like mushrooms. I like mushrooms.
Yeah. Well, you didn't have to out me as a no mushroom guy, but okay.
Domino's Pizza. That's the way to get the whole family together. And this is a great deal. Visit Domino's.com or use the app to order your large two-topping pizzas for $6.99 each. Carryout only. You must ask for this limited-time offer. Valid 4/22 through 4/28. Tax may apply. Prices, participation, and charges may vary. Sona, what would you do with $100 billion? Seriously.
Oh, I would buy a country.
Okay. I would buy just a ton of yachts and private jets, and I would duct tape them all together and then just have it go in a circle in the Pacific Ocean.
What?
Yeah. I don't know, just to be a total jerk. Anyway, there is a correct answer.
Oh.
And it's build incredible cities in fantastical locations while competing with your friends to be the biggest tycoon in the world. What do you think of that answer?
That's better than mine.
Yep, and mine, which you can do with Monopoly Go, the hit mobile game that's so much fun, it's been downloaded over 150 million times. It's the fun of classic Monopoly on the go, anytime, anywhere, endless new surprises like tons of boards and crazy mini games. You can team up with your chums on community chess and tournaments to get big money, or you can go after their fortune-changing rent on your properties or even pulling a bank heist on them. So much fun. It's incredible. So start building up your billions today. Go download Monopoly Go, now free on the App Store and Google Play. If you're being honest, no one really knows what you do for work, especially if you're in B2B. That's a business doing business with other businesses.
Oh, I didn't know you knew what that was.
I know exactly what that is. B2B, I use that all the time. Businesses doing businesses with other businesses. Fortunately, LinkedIn has a network of professionals who get what you do, and you can reach the right people who matter most to your company. LinkedIn has over 1 billion members on its platform, including 70 million decision makers.
That's good.
Since LinkedIn members are regularly updating their work history, you can precisely build a target audience by job title, industry, company, and more. Start reaching the right people for your, get ready, B2B business with LinkedIn ads. Gets even better because LinkedIn will give you a $100 credit on your next campaign.
That's crazy.
Yeah, just go to linkedin.com/teamcoco to claim your credit. That's linkedin.com/teamcoco. Terms and conditions apply. I get to say this again. Listen, LinkedIn, the place to be, right?
That's cool.
Business to business.
That's really cool.
I saw you did something on your show which absolutely floored me, Man Seeking Woman, and you did a piece where Hader is Hitler at a party, and he's like in a cool loft party.
Yes.
And there's a guy there who's like, and it's Hitler now, he's like 130 years old.
Yeah, that's based on one of my short stories, and the premise is actually the pilot of Man Seeking Woman.
Yes.
The very first episode. We led with 135-year-old Hitler.
I loved it because it was Hitler is at this party, and now he's dating this guy's girlfriend.
Yeah, yeah. The premise is that this guy, he finds out that his ex-girlfriend, this 20-something guy, his ex-girlfriend has moved on to someone new, and he's still in love with her, and now she's dating this older, richer guy, and he becomes even more upset when he finds out that person is Adolf Hitler, who is 135 years old, apparently faked his death and met his girlfriend or his ex-girlfriend in Buenos
Aires. And he's got money, and he's in a wheelchair.
He's in a wheelchair. I mean, he is 135, so he's right. Unimaginably old. But he is still with it. And his friends, his best friend, played by Eric Andre, is like, you know, give him a break, give him a chance. Like I know he's sort of sketchy, but like he's got great stories. And like, I think maybe
he's got a really cool apartment.
Cool apartment. And I think maybe you just don't like him because he's dating Maggie.
Adolf Hitler. And they're like, you know,
like maybe cool with that. Cause like we're at his apartment and like, there's like really good shrimp and like,
it's completely insane. Yeah. And I love how it was a really good hipster party. And of course, Hader, as you said, is so great at being, he's charming as an old Hitler. And, you know, there was some bad, you know.
He knows that he's done some questionable things.
Yeah.
But he also kind of has a sense of humor about it all. And Maya Erskine,
yep,
who now is this brilliant show, Pen 15,
yep,
is great as Maggie, as the ex-girlfriend.
Yep.
Who it builds to the point where she tells Jay Baruchel, who plays the main character, that he needs to apologize to Hitler for ruining his party.
Exactly.
And he has to say, "I'm sorry, Hitler." And then, Hitler is so, it is improvised.
Yeah.
Hitler is so old that he's extremely deaf.
I can't hit him.
Bill Hader's like, "What?" and then Jay has to apologize to Hitler louder.
Yeah.
And we have like one extended improv take where he has to apologize like 12 times because Hitler keeps forgetting.
So it's just
it.
So funny because I saw that and I thought, shit, you've ramped it up where Jay Baruchel has to say, "Sorry, Hitler," because he's really being a drag at Hitler's loft party.
At this really cool party.
Yeah.
Because when I was growing up, I really loved, like I said, I loved absurdist sketch comedy. And the other thing I was obsessed with was heartbreaking realist fiction.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would be watching Kids in the Hall, and then during commercial breaks, I would be reading like Carson McCullers and Richard Yates, like stuff that is not necessarily depressing, but like stuff that like can make you cry because it's so emotionally brutal.
Yep.
And I always thought, like, I wonder if you could do these at the same time. Like, I wonder if you can write a story about like unrequited love that is as brutal as Flannery O'Connor's story.
Yes.
But also have robots. And also have time travel and also have talking monkeys. Like, can you jam those two things together? And I remember asking like my English teachers, like, do you know any writers who like do that? And one teacher I remember told me it's impossible because the funnier something gets, the more superficial and hollow it becomes. And I remember thinking, I don't think that's true. And the reason why I don't think it's true is because of The Simpsons. Because The Simpsons, especially the era of The Simpsons that you were a part of, it's super silly, super absurd, and also incredibly emotionally grounded and moving and poignant, sometimes all within the same scene or even within the same joke. And so I was like, I know this can be done. And I've been trying with varying degrees of success to try to kind of do that thing of being silly, but also emotional at the same time.
Well, you know, I want to make sure I talk about this because New Teeth is that your new book of short stories, and I've devoured all of your short stories over the years, but there's so many stories in here where I found myself really laughing because it's so funny, but then there's something that feels sweet and real to me at the end that's earned. There's this story you wrote called Clabo. Please, if you're listening, go out and get New Teeth and read Clabo, because I read it, the entire story out loud to my family because I kept laughing so much.
I'm so happy you like that one.
But Clabo is, when I talk about being envious, I wish I had written Clabo. I'm going to start telling people I wrote Clabo. And just, you know what's going to happen? Most people won't bother to look up that you and find out that you wrote it. So there'll be a 3% will end up thinking I wrote Clabo. And that's all I want. But Clabo is a giant, like, superpowered ape that has saved Earth many times. And now, it's a couple of years later, no creatures have come from the sky in a long time, and they bring Clabo in and they tell him, basically, we can't afford your giant fortress of solitude. We can't afford. They tell him there's been some budget cutbacks.
Yeah.
So we're actually going to put you into a management situation.
Because they're polite, because, you know, he was a big hero to you know, many years ago, and they don't want to slight him. So they're, you know, as a conciliatory, they kick him upstairs, essentially.
Yeah. And they say, you're going to be our new senior coordinator for the Office of Community Affairs. And Clabo is impressed, you know. You're going to get your own office. And Clabo, now, of course, Clabo speaks the way you would imagine Clabo would speak. He is a giant ape creature. So Clabo's excited and says, "And Clabo going to need new clothes. Clabo need tie. Clabo need shoes. And Clabo need to go to bed by 10. He's saying this to his wife. Clabo need to leave early in the morning. Clabo need to allow time for learning. New commute. He's so excited. And then you get to this passage where he has a whole suit that he's picked out to wear to work. And I'm just going to read this because I just loved it so much. Clabo got to work 4 hours early. He didn't have a key card yet, so he spent the morning pacing around the lobby, stopping at each mirror to scrutinize his outfit. He still wasn't fully confident in his executive look. At 12 feet tall and 1,900 pounds, Shopping for business clothes had been a challenge. Mimi, that's his wife, had managed to find him a pair of quadruple X khakis. But when he'd tried them on at dawn, the seams had exploded, leaving him no choice but to tie the garment over his crotch like a diaper. In lieu of a tie, he painted a red stripe on his chest. His shoes were buckets.
I just was like, this is so delightful.
He shows up to work like that, and of course, he's used to battling space aliens, and now people at work are kind of snarky because he doesn't know anything about management. There's a lot of eye rolling, inner office politics.
He's just trying to hang with this new environment and trying to fit in and do a good job and serve the city in this new way. But
yeah.
He just doesn't have, he really only had one skill that everyone needed. And
which was, when it was Clawbo time, he could bash aliens.
Nobody was better at bashing these worms from space, but when it comes to figuring out the Wi-Fi password, it's very tricky for him.
Yeah, and they're trying to get him the Wi-Fi, and he's trying, and he just says, get me numbers, get Clawbo numbers. He knows that his job involves numbers in some way.
He thinks that he can fake it, that if he just keeps demanding, numbers of people, that somehow he'll succeed.
Yeah. Clawbo need numbers, he would say. You give Clawbo numbers now. And Kevin, who's like the young guy at the firm who has to kind of look after, is like, what numbers? You tell me, Clawbo would say. You are supposed to know which numbers. You find out which numbers and you show to Clawbo. I don't know what you want. I have no idea what you're talking about. And poor Clawbo, but I read it and I had so much, and there's a really sweet ending to the story. But I think one of the things you do so well is don't spend any time trying to massage a crazy premise. Just start by saying, Clawbo was a giant ape who protected Earth for years.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the way you do it. You know what I mean?
Thank you so much. I'm so happy you like that story. Some of my favorite short story writers are not comedy writers. Uh-huh. They're genre writers. So like Stephen King and Bradbury and Philip K. Dick and Shirley Jackson and T.C. Boyle. Like these are writers who take really big swings. The first sentence of a Bradbury short story, you're transported. Like by the end of the sentence, you know, okay, I guess I'm on this spaceship now.
Yeah.
And there's an alien loose, like you're right there. And I try to emulate those kinds of writers where like, that's why I prefer to write short story collections to novels. I have written a couple of novels, but I mostly write short stories because you can take these really big swings. You can just say, okay, yeah, here's a giant monkey man trying to learn how to be a middle manager in a bureaucracy. And then 10 pages later, when you're on to the next story, it can be a 1930s style noir, it can be
you wrote a great noir story in here about it's a baby who's basically the detective and there's another baby, a young girl baby who is the femme fatale who's hiring him to find out what's going on. And everything lines up with a great detective story, but you're talking about people that are, a year old?
Yeah, so the—
How old are they?
Yeah.
He can move, so I'm thinking he's about a year and a half old.
He's two.
Yeah, he's two.
He's two, and he's— It's called The Big Nap, and it's kind of modeled after, the Chandler Hammett novels. And he's 2 years old, and he is just, life is hard for him. You know, he is weary and tired.
Yes.
He's hitting the bottle all the time. He often will wake up and not know where he is. He's just, trying to keep it all straight and keep it all together in a world that makes no sense. And this femme fatale, this baby girl shows up with a missing unicorn, and she wants him to find it. And he's not sure whether to get mixed up with her because she has this like shady past. He doesn't exactly know where she came from. Some people said that she came from the hospital, but then there's also this rumor that she once lived inside of mommy's tummy. And so he doesn't really trust her, but she has Batman stickers.
Yeah.
That she's going to pay him. So he's like, hey, a job's a job.
Oh, I love it.
And then as the story progresses, like in all of these, in a lot of these detective noir novels from the 30s, 40s, 50s, he realizes, there's something about this screwy kid. Like I kind of like her. I think like
she's getting under his skin.
She's getting under his skin.
Yeah.
But then of course she ends up betraying him.
Yeah.
And then ultimately there's a happy resolution, and so it's like it is like a parody. It's satire. But what I was hoping to do is like. Emotionally, I was hoping to tell a story about like two siblings becoming friends. About a toddler learning maybe my baby sister is not so bad. Maybe we can coexist.
Maybe we can work this out.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's something you do exceptionally well, which is you take a story we all know, which is in this case the Chandler story, the tough Humphrey Bogart, the woman coming into the detective office who's in trouble. He's not going to fall for this, but he starts to, and then you flip it around. So we're seeing it through the eyes of these babies, which makes me see it in a completely different way. It's very disarming. One of my favorite things you did in that, it's a spoiler, but it doesn't matter because it's just that funny when you read the stories. There's a great moment because we all know that in detective stories, at some point they slip the detective a Mickey. And they slip the detective a Mickey.
It's inevitable.
It's inevitable. They put something in his drink,
yeah.
And then he wakes up somewhere, and he realizes that the bad guys drugged him. And in this one, he's trying to get away, and an adult clearly gives him like some Robitussin.
He wakes up in his
crib.
Yeah.
And it was great because it was just it slid over perfectly. It worked really nice.
And in that story, in that story, the grown-ups are. Essentially, the mob. They're the enemy.
Yes, yes.
And it's like he
a
knows.
Big nefarious group of grown-ups.
Yeah,
which is perfect. Yeah,
right. And they speak in code.
Right.
They're constantly disappearing. You don't know what they're up to. And he knows that it all goes back to Mama somehow. Like he knows that she's at the top.
Right.
And that everybody works for her.
Yeah.
Including especially Dada. But but like he doesn't know more than that.
Doesn't
he's
know.
Just trying
it's a
to,
shadowy world.
It's a shadowy world. You know, they have their secret. After hours, hang out at the TV room where, you know, they stay up late doing God knows what. And yeah, he's justly terrified of them.
Yeah. Well, this is, I'm going to really get into the weeds here with a question for you, which is something that has always fascinated me in comedy. And I see you do it sometimes really well. There's a story that you wrote in here, which is a really great, funny story about these two pirates that are just the worst, cruelest pirates ever. They literally, their beards are soaked with the blood of their victims. They talk like pirates. They're tough. And then they find this little girl that they've got to take care of. They're talking like pirates, but trying to figure out basically how to Ferberize the baby, like get her on a sleep schedule.
They end up having different parenting philosophies.
Yeah, they have different parenting philosophies in their...
They were a great duo. You know, when it came to killing people and stealing their gold and sailing the seven seas, they got along perfectly. And then when it comes to the question of how do we deal with this three-year-old girl... It's like, you know, like, maybe we should be getting her on some kind of schedule. You know?
Yeah. And then the other one's like, no, you know, because one pirate wants to keep her up all night and let her have fun. And the other's like saying, I think we should put her on a schedule. And then the first one's saying, well, you know, if she makes noise at four, we'll just handle it then. And then the second one, as we've all have heard this conversation in relationships many times, so you'll be the one getting up at four. And I thought, but one of the things I love is... There'll be a character like a Homer Simpson or whatever who's clearly not very bright, and the whole premise is that he's not very bright. But at a given moment—
He'll suddenly be a savant. And
yes.
He'll have full knowledge.
At a given moment, if it's funny for Homer to suddenly have access to great knowledge, he will.
Yes.
I was rewatching some episode that was not from my era, but, you know, Lisa makes some kind of joke about— or she's worried about her college career and— She says, you know, I don't know if I'll get into an Ivy. I might have to go to Vassar. And
he spits out. He says, no daughter of mine.
But he's also like, enough Vassar bashing in this house.
Oh, that's what it is. Sorry.
He says, I won't stand for any more Vassar bashing in this house. And I'm thinking, Homer doesn't even know what Vassar would be in any other reality. But suddenly he knows that there's an old trope of Vassar bashing in the Ivy Leagues.
And he defends it. And he defends Vassar. That's right. It's so great.
I've noticed that I bring it up because obviously that's a trick that you can do in comedy is suddenly a character has knowledge to just what to say. I've noticed that sometimes in your stories, you're really getting into the rhythm of this pirate language, and it's really great. And then suddenly a pirate knows, all right, you're just being passive aggressive now. And and suddenly he has access
right.
to something, to a level of knowledge of human behavior. We, in the 21st century, use the word passive aggressive all the time, but this pirate.
Yes, yes. And sometimes I'll be in situations where there'll be like a you know, either at the New Yorker or with one of my publishing houses, there'll be a very sweet fact checker who is like, because I get the copy edits, and I don't think an 18th century pirate would know this term.
Yes.
Or like, I don't think this slang word, you've been consistent for many paragraphs in a row, but I don't think that the Elephant Man would.
Well, see, this is what I was going to bring up.
Say you, that something was played out.
Yes. You know? Yeah, yeah. That's what I was going to bring up. You wrote this piece that I love called Case Study, and it's basically the story of the Elephant Man, and it's the diary of the physician who's helping him. But suddenly you'll keep doing this great rhythm thing where you'll change it up. It's all written as a medical report would be in the 1880s. But then, you know, he'll notice that the Elephant Man is kind of coming on to his wife by reading poetry in front of her.
He becomes obsessed with the theory that there's something going on between his wife and the Elephant Man.
Yeah, and the Elephant Man, and he's writing, and he's still writing in that 19th century style, but at one point he'll say things like, he's reading poetry again. I mean, he's really pushing it. And yeah. You'll think, well, no one would have said that, but it's hilarious.
At one point he asks rhetorically why she would do him like this.
Yeah.
which is extremely anachronistic.
Yeah, why would you do me? And there's another point that I really loved where you're suggesting that, you know, it's brought up that, well, possibly that they're having some kind of affair. And someone says, that wouldn't happen. This is Victorian England. Yeah. There's something akin to that where people right. are very aware that this is the Victorian era.
That's right. Well, the wife, yeah. Because the wife says, you're being jealous and ridiculous and insecure, but also like, he's clearly gay.
Yeah, yeah. He said, how do you know he's gay? Did he come out? And she said, well, no, he wouldn't come out. It's Victorian England.
People he's got enough going on. He doesn't need that also. So they somehow have knowledge of the time period they're in.
They're very self-aware.
Yeah. So that's, yeah, I mean, in terms of that whole trick, that the sort of the inconsistency that you're describing, like,
yeah.
I mean, the simple answer is I love it.
Yeah.
I think it's hilarious when yes. all of a sudden you learn like in a Simpsons episode that I wrote, you find out that Homer at one point self-published an autobiographical novel about his father, which is completely ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah.
So I love that device, but my rule is always if it's emotionally honest,
right,
you can be as inconsistent as you want.
It's that old David Letterman line of just accept the premise,
yes,
and go. And I remember there was a Simpsons episode again. I'm quoting stuff that I had nothing to do with, but Lisa's citing different people who I don't forget what it is. I forget exactly what the context is, but she's saying something and she says why, you know, even Supreme Court Justice Souter thought so. And Homer just goes, oh no, not Souter. You're like, Homer wouldn't know or care who Justice Souter is.
Right, but it's emotionally.
Oh no, not Souter.
But it's emotionally raw, you know, like.
I swear to God, I could do this all day. And maybe we should just have a podcast where you and I break down, get really into the weeds on comedy. But this has been absolutely joyous for me. So
thank you so much for having me.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I didn't want to, again. I'm just incredibly embittered by your success and your talent. But this was a delight, absolute delight. And I want to make sure that I tell people. You know, the nice thing about this podcast is I don't have to plug anything. That's what I love about it. For years and years and years, I was saying, well, okay, let's get to the clip. And what's really nice is I'm mostly talking to people and I mention what they're up to or I don't. But New Teeth Stories by Simon Rich, we're all need to laugh more. And man, this is a funny collection of stories and also really sweet. But hard, hard laughs. So please keep making this stuff.
Thank
you. It's really good.
Thank you. It really means the world to me. Thank you.
All right. I never want to see you again. show yourself out. Hey, check it out, Sona. Peak Design.
want to talk about them. They make travel gear that adapts to any trip, designed to help you create, commute, and explore.
Oh, that's nice.
It's incredible. Gear that's known for being meticulously engineered, ruggedly designed, responsibly made, and guaranteed for life. Guaranteed for life!
That's pretty sweet.
Yeah, that's like a wedding vow.
Yeah. Oh.
It's incredible. They sent us this backpack. It looks really nice. Yeah. It's a nice color. It's got a tech pouch. Keep all your cool tech stuff in there. Yep, well, that's nice. These guys are funny. They put the Mac and Me DVD in here. Paul Rudd will be thrilled. It's incredible. But I never travel without the Mac and Me DVD. I like these guys. Peak Design. And if you want to find out more, visit peakdesign.com/Conan for 20% off your first order. That's massive.
That is pretty good.
And then you can hit the road knowing you got Peak Design with you. There's no better traveling companion. I just made up a little catchphrase for them.
Hey, Keurig coffee drinkers. Did you know that the bold, smooth taste of Dunkin' cold coffee can be brewed in your Keurig coffee maker and enjoyed at home? Dunkin's cold K-Cup pods were crafted to be brewed hot and enjoyed cold. And of course, they're packed with the Dunkin' flavor you crave. Brew over ice and sip in seconds. Because the home with Dunkin' is where you want to be.
Once again, Sona is back with us in studio, joining David and I. The team is reunited. We're thrilled to have you.
Yeah.
How's it going?
So I wanted to talk about this one thing that happened to me, and I want to get your take on it, because I know Liza was always very open with your kids.
Mm-hmm.
So two of my friends were at my house, and they have a 7-year-old daughter.
Yes.
And she was like hanging out with me and whatever, feeding the kids. And then at one point I went to go change one of the diapers for one of the boys. And I take off his diaper and she goes, "Why does he have a tongue in between his legs?" And I go, "Well, that's his penis." She goes, "His what?" I go, "That's his penis. You have a vagina and he has a penis." And she goes, "What do I have?"
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
How old was she?
She was 7.
She was 27 years old. That's the scary part. And she's from Arkansas. This is horrifying.
I just
she graduated
know.
Law school. Wait. Oh, sorry. She's 7?
She's 7.
Yeah, she should know things at 7.
That's what I was saying.
And first of all, Liza, my wife, is from the... You explain everything, and you just are very, like, that's a fact. That's what you have. You have a penis. You have a vagina.
Yeah.
I'm uncomfortable even talking about it. those things weren't mentioned in my home, and my dad's a doctor. So
I know.
I grew up thinking I have a vagina, and was actually told by several doctors that it resembled. But anyway,
you we got several that. Doctors to tell well, you?
There was a surgery, and we're fine.
Oh, my God.
But the point is, and they can do miracles, so, you know.
I don't understand what you do.
In the medical community, okay. They can, whatever. From scratch, they pretty much built me functioning. Anyway, my point is that my wife is just very much, that's what it is.
Yeah.
And so there's no squirming or, so my question is, what is this girl's parents saying to her?
So she was very confused. And then, you know, and also it's very complicated now because there are men who have vaginas and women who have penises. And I didn't even want to get into that. So I kept it very
simple. No, you don't have to get into
simple.
That. You can keep it simple. Yeah.
And I was, you know, and then later on I went downstairs and I had to say to her parents, I go, "I just told your daughter what a penis and a vagina was."
Uh-huh.
And they were pretty, they were kind of upset at me.
No, really?
No.
But how can they be upset? What are you supposed to do if she follows you into the room? It's not like you introduced the subject.
No. And oh my God, I forgot at one point.
And it's not like you gave her a book, like, "And here's the big book of dicks, you know?" It's a Dr. Seuss book. Mr. Wix's has dickses. You know, you didn't do that. You were confronted while you were changing your boy's diaper with a question.
Yeah. And so, I forgot this part. So I was and I was like, "Yeah, you have a vagina." And then she goes, and then she was like confused. And then I go, "You know," I was like, "Did you not know this?" I was like, "He has a penis. You have a vagina." And then she looked at me and she goes, "I don't think you're supposed to be talking to me about this."
Oh, no!
And I got really uncomfortable. horrible. And then,
oh my God,
I just finished changing their diaper, one of their diapers, in complete silence. And this was so awful. No.
So, and you say the parents were not happy with you.
Yeah.
What would they have had you do in that situation?
I feel like they would have been like, they would have probably been better with me being like, ask your parents.
Yes, I see.
Yeah.
I see.
And I just.
That's not your jam. You don't.
Well, a similar thing happened with my niece. My husband's parents are divorced and they're both remarried. Mm-hmm. And so Ava was asking me, she goes, why does Tack have four parents? I go, well, because his parents are divorced. And then she goes, well, what's divorce? And I said, well, it's when two people who are married don't want to be married anymore. And then she goes, well, why wouldn't they want to be married anymore? And then we got deep. And then I was like, you know, love changes, things happen.
Yeah, love's pretty much a myth. Over time, as people age and they see the encroaching shadow of death, they realize we're here, but for a short time.
Oh, okay.
And we should probably taste other fruits.
Oh, no.
Wait.
Don't say taste other fruits.
Well, aren't I just saying what? Maybe I went too far.
Yeah.
Honey, I love you. But anyway, baby, you're the best. But no, how deep did you get with?
Well, we got deep. And then Danny and Lucy said that every time they would have like even a slight disagreement after that, Ava would ask them if they were going to get a divorce. Like she was kind of traumatized by it. But
well, all you have to say to Ava just before she's going to sleep is don't worry. Statistically, it only happens 50% of the time. And then turn the lights out and shut the door. And then start loudly arguing with your spouse. You don't make enough! I'm doing the best I can.
No.
You're not a real man! How am I supposed to live off this? Ava just sitting there listening in the dark.
Just a single tear.
A single tear. Oh, wow. Well, I don't know, Sona. I don't think you did the wrong thing.
I mm-hmm. hope not. I got really uncomfortable by it.
Yeah, has it ruined your relationship with these people?
No, we're fine. We're fine.
You should tell them they should be happy, because if I had been in the room with you and the little girl had said, what is that thing between his legs? I would have said, it's a cockaroo! It's a cockaroo! And I would have followed her down the stairs going, ah, cockaroo!
Oh, no, come on. I'm guessing Liza's the one who had to have all these talks with your children.
Yes, what would happen is a question like this would come up, and Liza would look at me, I'd look at Liza, and we usually keep the windows in our house open so I can just roll right out. And I would roll out onto a hedge below, and then I'd just run all the way till I hit the 405 freeway, and then I'd go north. And I'd look for water up in the hills to try and live off of for a while. And then I'd come back when the coast was clear.
Yeah.
But no, I think you answered that, the right way. I mean, yes, maybe you could have said you got to ask your mom. But that's weird, too.
That is weird.
Because it's like.
Then you're making it weird.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yes.
Then she can become like you. And you don't want that.
Well, I mean, clearly whatever happened to me yielded an incredible gift to the world, really, if you think about it. I hear crickets.
Yeah, sound it.
We should
right
put crickets
that.
In here. A genius, a solitary, lone voice that could unite a torn world. More crickets, please. This is good. A real genius, the Michelangelo of comedy. More crickets, please.
Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend, with Conan O'Brien, Sona Movsesian, and Matt Gourley. Produced by me, Matt Gourley. Executive produced by Adam Sachs, Joanna Solitaroff, and Jeff Ross at Team Coco, and Colin Anderson and Cody Fisher at Earwolf. Theme song by The White Stripes. Incidental music by Jimmy Vivino. Take it away, Jimmy. Our supervising producer is Aaron Blair, and our associate talent producer is Jennifer Samples. Engineering by Will Beckton. Talent booking by Paula Davis, Gina Batista, and Britt Kahn. You can rate and review this show on Apple Podcasts, and you might find your review read on a future episode. Got a question for Conan? Call the Team Coco hotline at 323-451-2821 and leave a message. It, too, could be featured on a future episode. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to Conan O'Brien Needs a Friend on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever fine podcasts are downloaded.
This episode was produced and edited by me, Brett Morris.
This has been a Team Coco production in association with Earwolf.
Hey, Keurig coffee drinkers. Need a cold coffee with a bold flavor? Dunkin' Cold K-Cup Pods were specially crafted for cold coffee. Brew over ice straight out of the Keurig coffee maker for smooth, delicious Dunkin' taste you know and love. Find your next Dunkin' Cold coffee in the roasted coffee aisle.
Time for a quick break to talk about McDonald's. Mornings are for mixing and matching at McDonald's. For just $3, mix and match two of your favorite breakfast items, including a sausage McMuffin, sausage biscuit, sausage burrito, and hash browns. Make it even better with a delicious medium iced coffee. With McDonald's mix and match, you can't go wrong. Price and participation may vary. Cannot be combined with any other offer or combo meal. Single item at regular price.